Hi, apparently I'm the better one at starting the show cold. Welcome. My name is Dan.
I'm Naz, and this is The Gender Knot, and we are going to talk about how we're changing direction this week.
Yeah, we got a really exciting program. We got three main points we want to get to. One, we're going to talk about changing direction, and then we're going to talk about new topics and ideas, and then what's the third thing we're going to do?
Disenfranchised men. It's the topic that keeps coming back, man.
Right. Round three. We should just change the name of this show to the Disenfranchised Men Podcast with Naz and Dan.
I mean, pretty much a lot of the topics are, you know, at the root about disenfranchised men or about men feeling like what the hell's going on. So, yeah, maybe that's why it hit a nerve.
It really has.
Maybe because we pissed everyone off because we sounded really cavalier.
I don't know.
So we're going to start with the changing direction of the show. If you've been tuning in for a while, you might have noticed that the past couple of weeks, the show has taken on a little bit of a different vibe, I guess. Originally, I think it was... Well, I mean, okay, I build it as an ideas podcast, so as a sort of open exploration of these concepts of changing masculinity and femininity, but we've gotten really interested in diving into the nitty-gritty of how men and women relate, especially given this time period where everyone's super confused.
Yeah, instead of thinking about things on like this globalist, stratospheric, everything and nothing attitude, we're now kind of really probing in on like what we can do on an individual level to interact with other human beings.
Yeah, so we're going to have less sort of abstract concepts or sort of open exploration of ideas. So we're still going to have a lot of experts, but, and this is where you will come in, we're going to have a lot more of the audience. A lot of you have been writing into us, and that is really fun. We'd like to get a lot more of you onto the show. So we're going to have a little bit of a mix of having some experts, having the audience participate, and yeah, just try to figure out how we can get on better. Because I think there's a lot of concepts that I guess the sort of person who tunes into this show would agree with about how men and women should be in the modern age. But what is really interesting is how these things play out on a practical level.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think just to stop on iTunes at a show called The Gender Knot, you probably have a pretty good attitude, right? In like the grand scheme of like, yeah, men and women should be nicer to each other. I should listen to this podcast. And so I think really hammering in on big picture stuff isn't really going to get us anywhere. So we really need to dive into, well, what the hell does that look like for me specifically? And my, I don't know, well, like the walls that I've built personally, how do I tear those down?
Right. Yeah. And I think we're all well-meaning, but still piss each other off. So if the
That's
emails
the
we get...
That's the definition of our relationship.
And also... If the emails that we get say anything, it's like, oh, I agree with your overall purpose, but I disagree with the way you did it.
I agree with your overall purpose, but I think you personally are an asshole, is what usually comes to me.
I want to read out one of the emails we got recently because it hones in on the changing direction of this show. So we got an email from an Indian listener called Abby. He said to us that in your discussions, the archetypal male is almost always a 30 plus middle to upper class white Anglophone, very often an American guy. But given that you're talking about masculinity in general, this group is a small subset of people in the world and only barely a majority of men, even in the US. When I do hear, mostly Naz, talking about men from other cultural groups, it's always in the context of, well, men from other cultures also do things similarly when talking about a particular phenomenon. Just to make it clear, I am not asking you to make a token episode talking about how minority men are victimized and to be done with it. I'm hoping that you can include other male perspectives in your show. Minority men in the developed world, immigrants, dirt poor white men, middle class white men whose families have slipped into poverty, dominant men in the developed world, men from privileged backgrounds in the developing world who are now the minorities in their adopted developed country, the categories are infinite. And then he goes on to say, it's simply disappointing to listen to episode after episode about men without ever having your existence acknowledged. Despite the points I've mentioned above, I don't just want you to think of non-white and poor white men only as victims. You should also talk about how these categories of men propagate misogyny and toxic masculinity. But a better representation of the full spectrum of men that exist in the world is necessary to truly talk about masculinity as a social construct. Okay, so this was interesting receiving this. I'm going to be really clear. This podcast is pretty much about straight white men, and I'd say middle to upper class straight white men in Anglophone countries. There's several reasons for that. Personally, I think that that is the group that has the most privilege, not just where I live, but on the global stage. So these are the kind of guys who become politicians and they become heads of new technology companies who completely change the way we interact with each other, and they become Supreme Court justices. And I think it's really important to see what is going on with this group that has such an enormous influence on shaping society and our future. I say this as someone who lives in a country that's our economic future is being driven off a cliff because of a bunch of very privileged white men who haven't sorted out their squabbles from school. I mean, that's basically what Brexit is about.
Dude, we live in the same kind of country.
Right. I'm getting really heated talking about it. So that's not to say that other men or other people in society aren't important. They are, but specifically, we're interested in tackling this group.
Right. Frankly, like, I am a 35-year-old straight white American cisgendered male who's like middle class. Like, I am like the exact thing that he described us talking about. And that's all I feel comfortable talking about.
Right.
At least in like a who should be doing shit better attitude. Like, I'm only going to talk about the thing that I am, because as the 35-year-old straight white cisgendered American male, I don't really have the authority to tell other people how to shape up.
Well, also because this show is a talk show. Again, maybe this is to do with our changing direction, because it's less kind of going to be like an open exploration of ideas. It's going to be more about the nitty gritty of how we relate. The other really important thing is that we all make this podcast on top of other jobs that we have. And it's hugely time consuming. If we wanted to make a sort of documentary style show that went into all these concepts, that's something that requires a team working full time and a huge budget. I mean, I host documentaries on public radio. A half hour documentary takes about 20 to 30 days to make. There's four different people involved in it. There's a budget of a couple of £1,000, and we do not have any of those resources at all. So we aren't going to be making that kind of a show. That's not feasible. This show is going to be a very different thing from stuff like that. And speaking of how time consuming this is, if you're appreciating the conversations that are going on and you think this is important, we would love for you to contribute financially. You can support our Patreon from $1 a month, or you can pay $5 a month, $20 a month, you know, help keep these conversations going, and yeah, help us out.
Yeah, that's like no money on like a one person scale. $5 a month, I could do that.
It's like one of those fancy Starbucks coffees that are seasonal.
No, it's not even $5. That's a cold brew at Starbucks.
So yeah. Cool, help us out. Thank you so much. Speaking of more audience participation, we would love to get more ideas from you. Loads of you are writing to us, and we would love to hear more.
Yeah, especially if it's about disenfranchised men.
So actually, last week, our co-producers Sam and Johnny did a really great episode called Let's Talk About Sex.
It was so good.
Yeah. No, it was really
so
good. Yeah, and also, sex is a topic we need to talk about more. So they were looking at pornography and what it does to relationships. They spoke to Cindy Gallup, who's huge. And Dan and I didn't know what the show was going to be until it went out, because I was like, yeah, this can be a surprise. And when I saw it, I was like, whoa, this is fantastic. First of all, because I was like, we never talk about sex. And I was like, yeah, they went there, which was great. And then they had
Cindy
Gallup.
Well, you told me we can't.
Yeah. This, well,
you said because you're Middle Eastern, we can't talk about sex. Yeah, I have that in writing somewhere, I think.
You're Catholic.
Yeah, I know. Kind of. Like, on paper.
Like, what
I guess.
Do you and me know, right? Right.
Yeah, well, enough.
But we do need... I often feel like we need to talk about sex more. And
I think so. It's important. I mean, if we're going to talk about masculinity and femininity...
Yeah, so we're going to have to go there. So especially if you've got thoughts on last week's episode, we think that's a great conversation to pick up and do more on.
And, you know, feel free to spread your thoughts out. They don't just have to be sex or nothing. And we especially want to hear from men. You know, this is something we've been calling out for a little while. Men who are trying their damnedest and just don't know how to act in 2018. We actually got a really great email from a guy named Jack, who's 24. And I think a grad student in the Boston area. What's really neat is that we were emailing another fella, a guy named David Lyon, who actually has like an online summit about, you know, how men can be getting better. And so I read the letter to David and we got some advice. We can play that right now. So we got this. It's from Jack. Jack says, I am a 24-year-old single male from outside Boston. The recent episode about disenfranchised men evoked a lot of emotions for me. I connected with the notion of men feeling dispensable, but I also think the issue is much bigger than that. To be honest, I am by no means disenfranchised. My parents are well-educated and very forward-thinking. I attend an elite college and am a social worker who works with gang-involved youth. Compared to many of my male peers, I more or less, quote, have my shit together, as Naz would say. I have my own therapist, have worked really hard to be emotionally aware and expressive, and am trying to do the work of being a good man and an overall decent human. However, what you all said about men feeling left out and devalued resonated with me. I often feel as though I only get my sense of identity and worth from my work. It feels as though people only see me as what I do, not who I am. Trying to be emotionally honest often falls on deaf eyes. My male friends want nothing to do with it, and my female friends get annoyed. I totally understand why it can be emotional labor for them. Sometimes it seems like no matter how hard I try to do the work, it is never enough, and that I will always fall short, and that is really discouraging. So that leaves me feeling as though I don't have many places or people to turn to so that I can be my authentic self. I believe that men's mental health, or lack thereof, is quietly killing us all, and we are not taught or given the tools to work on that, nor allowed the opportunities to express ourselves healthily. Boys and young men don't have any of this in their vocabulary. We are only taught happy and angry, and then we grow up to become aggressive and violent men. I am not trying to justify or excuse bad behavior by men, but rather offer some explanation and compassion. Saying boys will be boys is very problematic, and it is just the tip of the iceberg. Unlearning all those unhealthy behaviors is really hard work, even for the most educated and engaged among us. And as hard as I try, it can feel like it will never be enough. So David, that comes from Jack, and I kind of just wanted to get your thoughts on it and maybe get some advice for him on how he can be either better received or less phased or discouraged, or just kind of like your overall thoughts on that.
Well, so first of all, I have a lot of respect for what Jack is going through and for, yeah, just the deep work that he's immersing himself in. And the first thing I would say is that nothing of this experience in itself is wrong, even though I hear that it's super uncomfortable. But I find that it's very often this process of, you know, becoming aware of some patterns, both within myself and within my societal structure, that when I'm aware of it, the first step is not to have the solution, but to see how painful it is that this is the state that we are in. That's, for me, really important to acknowledge that this is, in most processes, the first step to see, wow, there's stuff going on that is really painful. Like he's saying, I'm sharing myself emotion, you know, in an honest, vulnerable way, and I'm not being received in the way that I would like to.
Do you think that that's maybe an origin point of why men might not like to share their feelings, because it is painful?
For sure. I mean, I think we're in our society where we don't understand the value of pain and the value of suffering, which is learning. Hmm. We learn through that. So this is always the first step, to not make it wrong to experience pain and experience suffering, but to see, what can I learn from that? And as Jack is saying, to have compassion for ourselves for this process, because most people are not willing to acknowledge their suffering even. So that's why I'm wanting to stress how powerful it is to acknowledge that suffering. On a more practical level, there are two threads that come to mind when I hear what Jack is saying. One is, I think there is a certain skill involved in expressing yourself vulnerably that makes it easier for other people to receive you in a loving way. And that is a lot about taking responsibility for your own emotions. So when I share with someone else how I'm feeling, I'm not making them responsible for changing that. And that can be quite a subtle thing that might take some time to really embody this kind of, oh, I'm feeling angry right now. And I feel okay expressing my anger, but it's not your fault that I am angry right now. It's my responsibility to take care of my anger.
Yeah, I'm just telling you about it.
Exactly. And there's a, and that's the vulnerability, because it's a very, we're not in control of our emotions. We can be aware of our emotions, but we're not in control of them. So sharing what is going on for me emotionally is a very vulnerable thing that many people are not willing to go into. So it takes a lot of courage to do that. And then the skill of, it's basically the difference between a child and an adult. The child needs support in going through the emotional experience that is happening. It goes to its parents for the support, for being told, hey, this is okay. This, yes, this is an uncomfortable experience, but everything is okay. That's what children do. But as adults, we're asked to kind of do that internally, to be our own parent and say, hey, this is okay that you're experiencing anger.
Right, right. Well, and sometimes we don't feel like it is okay because we don't see it in other people, maybe.
Yes.
Because other people are giving us the example that emotional vulnerability, or at least visible emotional vulnerability, is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And so they never say it, we never hear it, we learn to never say it.
Yeah. Totally. And this is where the other thread comes in that I had in mind, which is around choosing the people who are willing to relate on that level. You know, it's easy to turn the current dogma around how it is okay to relate, to turn it around and make it another dogma that everyone should be vulnerable all the time. And I think that's not helpful either. I think some people are really want to go into that and other people don't. And so by developing your clarity on how is it that you want to relate to other people, you might find that some people in your life are just not willing to meet you on that level. And so to be willing to find other people who want to explore with you, where you don't feel like you're a burden, but you're actually supporting them in their development as well, I think is really, really powerful.
Right, right. Obviously, you know, step one, it sounds like, is finding out who I actually am and how I want to communicate with the world in a way that's going to feel okay. And then step two is kind of like doing that. And step three is kind of like finding out who among my circle is going to be receptive and who isn't. And then expanding that circle to find more receptive people.
Yeah, totally. And it's a circular process, because through relating to people who are more and more willing to go with me on these levels that I want to go to, for example, relating vulnerably and honestly to each other, the more I do that, the more I learn about myself. So I also learn through the experience.
Right. Sometimes, I mean, it's that whole thing about where if I can tell you how I'm feeling, you know, you mentioned we can't control our feelings, but when I can talk about them and do that parent-child thing where I say how I'm feeling and you go, I've felt that way too, it's going to be okay. That's when I grow, right? Like that's when I find out that it's not bad to have that feeling. It's normal to have that feeling. And that feeling will pass just like every other feeling I've ever had.
Yeah.
And not in that place in my head where I go, I'm having this feeling and it's wrong and it's never going to end.
Yeah. You know, Jack did write that he has his own therapist. And I think it can be really helpful to have these containers where the setting is very, very clear, where we can explore. And in these clear containers, and that can even be with a friend, you know, asking them, hey, would you be willing to just listen to me for 10 minutes? I would just really like to share what's going on for me. And you don't need to give me any advice. I would just love for you to be present with me.
I think we've got some really good stuff for Jack here. And then I want to talk about what it is that you're doing with this summit. Can you just kind of give me, you know, maybe like a 30-second or a 1-minute kind of rundown of what that is and how people can get involved?
So this online summit is on the topic of wholehearted and grounded masculinity. And what that means for me is that I want to encourage men to fully connect to their hearts in a way that feels powerful to them instead of disempowering and getting into this victim mode and like a sensitive new age guy kind of way. What I did was I interviewed almost 30 men who have lots of experience with working with men, many, many experts in the fields of men's development, men's work, spirituality. And we've just had really raw, open conversations around what does it mean to be a man who lives connected to his heart and connected to his balls, to his power.
Heart and balls.
People can simply go on the website summit.evolving-men.com and sign up for free, and then they receive free interviews every day delivered to their inbox.
Awesome. It sounds like a really great project, and I really appreciate you hanging out and giving Jack some advice. Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
So that takes us into the third and final part of this week's episode, which is disenfranchised men, the topic that keeps giving.
Yeah, the topic that refuses to itself be disenfranchised.
So we wanted to come back to this because we've gotten so much mail from everyone about this. I want to start with a really interesting email we got from Uganda. Can you believe we have people listening in Uganda? Isn't that really exciting?
I simply won't believe it.
We got a really interesting email. It's from a 22-year-old man called Dragan. I'm going to read out what he said to us. He said, I had a problem with the title itself, Dealing with Disenfranchised Men. Alex, that week's guest, pointed out something which is very important, but which you seem to not take seriously. He said, and I quote, you don't get into that second group without being a member of the first. In short, a disenfranchised man is that privileged man who has been told, look, what you're doing is bad and you need to do better, but instead takes offense. This means that the so-called disenfranchised men are simply parasites who've been feeding off an unjust society. The current tilts in society don't make them disenfranchised men. It makes them people who are unwilling to adapt to a fair society. And if we treat them the way you suggested in round two of the show, we will be pampering them. That will make it seem like society is unfair to them, when in actual case, they are the ones who are very unfair to society. I think comparing disenfranchised men to depressed people or minority groups is a comparison that's not quite correct. You cannot sit there and fail to understand, fail to listen, fail to act, but instead plot revenge and hurt people around you, etc., and expect to be massaged and told it's okay. I don't think disenfranchised men can be helped by being offered a hand, like Alex was suggesting. The reason they are or feel disenfranchised is because they've refused to understand and are unwilling to change for the better in the first place. Being disenfranchised should be enough to open their eyes to the injustice they have been doing to society. What I'm trying to say is the whole idea of a disenfranchised man is not quite correct, and we shouldn't be doing anything for them. Instead, disenfranchised men owe society an apology. So that is a listener from Uganda.
Oh, snap.
I thought it was quite interesting, actually. So you need to have listened to part one and two of the disenfranchised series, I guess, now.
Saga.
Saga. To know what's going on. But that is interesting. And what is interesting is that we have some voice memos we're going to play as well from some listeners from elsewhere.
Hi, this is Leigh. I'm from Canada. I'm a physician who's also a woman of color. I really enjoyed the podcast on disenfranchised men. I also enjoyed the lively discussion that ensued. I just had a couple of quick thoughts that I was sharing with Nastor. And so there's a listener who took issue with the fact that he kind of perceived Dan and Naz, they were criticizing men with depression. And that's not how I heard their commentary at all. I think it's great that despite all these distances that we have between us and differing societies and cultures, that the podcast audience has that separate us, we're able to find, you know, common ground and discuss these issues. But I think that we also need to be careful not to misinterpret someone's intent, especially when it comes to these issues that tend to be kind of incendiary. I didn't take them to be criticizing men with depression. And maybe this is also me taking their commentary and applying it to my own experience, but I took their criticism to be a valid one, and against this kind of male who sort of bemoans their lot in life in this apathetic manner, and instead of taking that dissatisfaction and converting it into motivation to do something productive and move forward in society, they'd rather blame or put down others in an effort to kind of rein those people backwards and look relatively better in comparison. And so these are the individuals who kind of tell females or who tell minorities in post-secondary education, you know, you only got there because you're filling a quota, or the individuals who looked at the women's and men's women's and minority groups in university and said, oh, well, where's the support group for white males? And again, these are both things that I've heard in my own personal experience. It's probably the few of the less harsh things that I've heard in my experience. But these people are representative of these kind of resentful individuals that we women and we minorities who don't belong to that sort of white male power majority that we come across. They're individuals who haven't had to live their lives on guard, thinking that people might mistake them for a criminal, or thinking that people might call them a slut or the N-word, or, you know, oppress them in ways associated with gender, or even question their very presence in an environment in which they are the minority, which is something that we women come across very much so in the workforce and out in society. That's something that we people who are kind of historical minorities and or put down people, including women, have to endure every single day. We've had to do it historically. We had to do it, you know, today. We'll have to do it tomorrow. And sort of carrying that adversarial experience on our shoulders, maybe that's what leads us to kind of readily criticize the people who don't have to go through this and who kind of just bemoan their life experiences, having not shouldered that adversity.
Hey, Gendernaut, this is Lily calling from Australia. I just paused the second episode on disenfranchised men because I just want to make the point that if quote-unquote shaming men isn't the way to go, then there's really nothing we can do about men who become extremists. Basically, it just sounds like that dude from New York thinks that women shaming men about things like living in their mum's basement is what is making these men into MRAs. But I think that if those men are that close to becoming violent misogynists, then they don't really need like the extra push from women to get there. It's sort of like white people threatening to become extra racist if you're not nice to them. They're already racist, and really nothing that people of color will do or say to them is going to make them more racist, like quote unquote more racist, because they already think that. They just maybe can't admit it to themselves.
The second voice memo was from Lily. She is 27. She works in theatre. She describes herself as a white passing Indigenous woman. She also said in an email, and said that it's okay to read this out, she said that, "I don't buy the depression is a factor argument. Even I've had depression since 10, and I'm not out here doxing and threatening to kill strangers on the internet. Or, you know, literally murdering my wife, kids, entire family, or mass shooting strangers." So that's an extra note from Lily. What is interesting is that all those people are people of colour. And so it was interesting for me that they reacted that way, because I think many of the white people who, I'm just going to say it, many of the white people who've written to us, male or female, have reacted very differently.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That's a good point. I hadn't even put that together. But yeah, a lot of our white people, and hey, listen, as a white person, I can talk shit about white people. A lot of our white people are very like, "These poor fellas."
It's strange because in some ways I do have sympathy, because sometimes when you are the quote unquote dominant group, you're not really forced to think about your identity. In fact, over the summer, we put out an episode by our friends, the podcast Ministry of Ideas. They're a fantastic podcast out of Harvard Divinity School. They had done an episode called White Balance, which was about race relations in the US. And something really interesting that came up, and which actually gave me shivers, I think it was the poet and academic Joshua Bennett, who is African-American. He was talking about his students, who he teaches at college, and how often the white students will say that they don't really have a race, or that they're nothing. And he said in an incredulous way, I mean, how can you be nothing? And that's an interesting thing, because I think if you're the dominant group, you kind of haven't really been forced to grapple with your identity.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not that we're nothing. It's that we're normal. You know what I mean?
Well, you've not had to think about it, right?
Well, yeah, what I'm saying, I don't mean that just like, I know what that sounds like.
No, I know, but it's
intentional satire.
It's exactly what Leia was saying, the Canadian lady in the voice memo, where she was saying about how people of color or women have had to sort of deal with how other people react to them all the time.
Right.
So,
right. I mean, I have the privilege, speaking of privilege, I have the privilege of being on this show and week after week being confronted with things that I've not had to think about. And a lot of guys don't have that. It's a thing where, like, yeah, television, movies, society, the government, everybody just makes us the default. And, you know, I say everybody makes us the default. We are the ones making us the default on a broader scale. But it's one of those things where what's to think about when you're the baseline? But do you know what I mean?
I think this is part of the problem, you know, and I'm guilty of doing this as well. But sort of if you are the default or the more privileged group, there is the sense that you shouldn't be complaining, right? And I will often say, oh, you know, you're a privileged white male. What are you complaining about? That still doesn't mean that you don't need to explore these issues.
Right.
So no, maybe it's a double-edged sword. Well, maybe it goes back to what Jack from Massachusetts was saying earlier, where he says that, you know, it's never enough what he does. Because, Dan, I'm wondering, you as a middle-class, straight, white guy.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A.K.A. the problem.
Well, I don't want to say it, but...
Yeah, we can say it. It's fine.
Is it hard for you to explore your identity? Because, I mean, me as a woman and as a Middle Eastern woman, you know, I can explore my identity in those ways. But I'm wondering, you... Going back to that episode of Ministry of Ideas, where Joshua Bennett is surprised at his white student saying, I'm nothing... Do you think it's hard for someone like you to explore his identity, what it means to be male, what it means to be white, what it means to be relatively privileged, both nationally and internationally?
Oh, that's such a tough question. I mean,
like, do you have the space to do that, or do you even think about it? Because now is the time when people like me are pushing you to get it together.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if it's hard, but it's very complicated. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, it's once the work is in motion, it's not like difficult, but it's very complicated to look at all the stuff about being a white guy.
I mean, in a way, though, the fact that you're a middle class white guy, does that make you feel like you're not allowed to complain, or you're not allowed to have struggles, or you're not allowed to not be on top of things because you are the most privileged class? So, you know, why are you complaining?
Well, I had spine tumors.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing I really complain about.
But like, because life is hard for everyone. And I'm thinking of, I've had a lot of men in my life, be they friends, be they people I've been in relationships with, be they colleagues, who are privileged upper middle class white guys who I know have been struggling. And I've seen them in private and the way they are in private, and they are really struggling. And part of me is sympathetic. Part of me isn't, because I'm like, you have the resources to get help. But maybe it's more complicated than that.
Well, that I think that compounds the problem, right? The idea that I'm not supposed to feel this way. And that's something that David and I talked about, which is the idea that when we actually open up about our emotions, we can learn from them, right? Because if we're not talking about it because we're not supposed to feel that way, because when we do tell people, they go, you have the resources to deal with it, don't tell me, then we can't grow. We can't change. We just eat that shit. And we swallow it and we die of an ulcer, or, you know, we become, you know, left out or whatever, or any number of variants. So we have to have the space to talk about what we're feeling, and we have to be able to listen to each other and understand that pain is relative, right? Like, pain and emotions are relative. And whether you're at the top of the pile or the bottom of the pile, your 10 is a 10 and your 1 is a 1. And my 10 might not be your 10, but it's still my 10 and your 10, and that needs to be respected.
Well, this kind of makes me feel really torn, because, like I said, on one hand, I'm really sympathetic to this group because of the fact that they are privileged and it's as though they can't talk about it. But then at the same time, should I be doing the work? And I know this comes up again and again. And actually, Emily from California wrote to us about this.
Oh, dude, she dug you such a grave in this.
I mean, she had a bit of a point. I mean, you know, sometimes you agree and disagree. So Emily, she's 29. She's a middle-class white woman from California. She said, I find it really weird when people who devote their time to discussing gender issues, including toxic masculinity, say they don't have the time or energy to help men. Is that not an inherent contradiction? If you're already working to improve gender relations, you're already working to help men. After all, much has been said about how damaging the patriarchy is to men and how toxic masculinity is currently one of the most damaging things for women. Like it or not, helping men and furthering the cause of feminism seems increasingly like the same project. It's funny reading that, and then at a later point, Emily said something about how once you've decided that you want to put in the time and effort into trying to solve the problem, say, by starting a podcast about the topic, it seems like the question of whether or not you have to should take a backseat to what you can do if you want to. And I know I probably sound really confusing on this show, because on one hand I'm like, oh, let's help men, but then I only have a certain amount of patience, and I don't know. I feel like this is maybe hard for all of us, because I know the slippery slope is that there's a difference between showing compassion and showing understanding and being walked all over. And I'd like to say, because this has come up with a few people, I have never, ever said that compassion is a weakness in women. I think it's a wonderful thing. I just think women should be careful that it's not used against them, that women being compassionate is not used as a way for women to be forced to enable bad behavior and to not be able to assert themselves. I think compassion's a really strong and wonderful gift, but don't let it be used against you. But yeah, that, yeah, it is that feeling of it's this slippery slope, like, oh, if I'm, you know, understanding and helpful to the most privileged group in society, it's just a slippery slope of they're gonna expect me to let them off the hook.
Right. And so we have to listen for key indicators when someone's talking about whether or not they're genuinely asking for help or if they're trying to manipulate us.
But just going back to you yourself, do you feel like you've got spaces where you can explore your identity as a white, middle class, straight male?
I suppose. I mean, I have this show. That's really helpful.
You paused this for a really long time, though.
I had to think about it.
Right.
Because, again, it's not something that I tend to. It's not. This isn't something that tends to be at the forefront of my mind. And I know it should be. And I try to keep it there. You know what I mean? But
you and I met through your other podcast, Fine and Dandy with Dan and Andy, which is two cisgendered, white, straight men trying to be better allies. So clearly there must be some sort of social pressure or some sort of bigger reason that is making you think, oh, I should be A, a better ally, and B, I don't know, doing something about my identity. I don't know.
I think what it was for me that got me to want to do that show, which led to this show, is, you know, I grew up in this country where I was told over and over and over again growing up, over and over and over again, that everybody has the same chance. Everybody has a fair start in America. Everybody's treated equally, and anybody can do anything, and anybody can be whatever they want. And then as I got older and I moved around a little bit, and, you know, social media started to exist, and the news actually started talking about what's going on, and you start seeing all of these circumstances that were never brought up where I grew up in white-ass Seattle, the whitest place in the entire world that I've ever been. I've never been somewhere so dumbfoundedly white. Like, Seattle doesn't even realize how white it is. You know what I mean? Like, if you go to the deep south, they understand they're white and they're proud of it.
Right.
But in Seattle, people are like, wait, what? I'm white? No. I had to convince my parents over Thanksgiving that Seattle is the whitest place on earth, and they were shocked.
But wait, do they get defensive about it? Like, they should somehow feel bad that they're white, or what?
No, they just were like, oh my God, you're right.
Right.
And which is like, yeah, I mean, look around. There's no brown or black or anything in this neighborhood.
Well, it's funny because in the UK, we don't talk about race at all, and we kind of pretend it doesn't exist, which I find interesting given that, you know, the UK had this huge empire not that long ago. I feel like we just pretend it doesn't exist, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's a similar thing, you know?
Very similar. Seattle and the UK are like sister cities.
No, people always say that, and the weather is the same, and the people are nice, but
uptight.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, the more social experience I've had as an adult, the more I've realized that, like, the shit that we're sold in school, that everybody's the same and that everything is equal and everybody has the same chance, it's dog shit. And, you know, the past few years, like, that has been exploding in society. It's obviously it's not as crazy as it was in the 50s and 60s with dogs and fire hoses and shit, but
well, but people of color still get gunned down in your country. So
well, yeah, children, right? Unarmed children
by police,
get shot by the police.
Right.
And now we're in an age where like that's making the news. That I'm sure that's been happening forever. Mm-hmm. And only just no one cared or no one talked about it before. And so now we're in this place where people are actually talking about it, and I'm actually realizing, and it's like embarrassing to say out loud, but like, you know, this is stuff that I'm starting to realize for the first time. I mean, not today, but within the past 5 or 10 years, I've been like, oh my God, there's so much going on in the world that I was just completely blind to. And so, you know, I made a decision to start looking at it.
But do you feel guilty for being a straight, white, middle-class male?
No. I only feel guilty for like I only feel guilty if I have an opportunity to take action and I don't. You know what I mean? And like there's probably a lot of years in my life where I wasn't doing the right thing. You know what I mean? I wasn't aware of what was going on around me. And so I don't necessarily feel guilty about not knowing what was going on because I was raised in a society that told me everything was fine, just keep doing what you're doing. And so I don't think that that's my fault. But once I became aware of it, yeah, it's my fault if I'm not doing something. And so I try to do things now. So, yeah. And so my whole thing is now I have to do something. And so to answer your question, I mean, I have this space. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have this. Maybe we should ask that question. You know what I mean? Because obviously, like, I'm on a podcast talking about gender. But what does everybody else do? You know what I mean? If you're a white guy listening, what do you do? What, like, how do you explore your identity as a straight white man? And if you're not those things, what do you suggest? You know what I mean? What have you used to explore your own identity as not a straight white man that you might think would work or you haven't tried but think that we should try anyway? I think that would be really fun to read. If you wanted to email that to us.
So that was this week's show. I'm Naz.
I am Dan.
Our co-producers are Sam Baker and Jonathan Blackwell. We will be back next week where we will be talking about meltdowns and whether men can have them.
Ooh.
Speak to you then. Bye.
Bye.